hello and welcome to Mike's Arla podcast episode 135 for the 27th of July 2017. Well, back to my desktop setup this week, and the weather's more normal, not so extremes as we've had recently, although balancing the amount of heat was also enough rain to keep plants watered, so things have been growing well, and the cucumbers are all looking fruity, although maybe fruity isn't the right word for a cucumber. Right, so let's go into the Google Groups and see what's been going on this week. Been a bit busier than it was last week. I just came in at the end of the podcast last week. I noticed Ian had posted up about some bits and pieces that he'd bought for stock for various power tools. High-speed steel taps and dies in various sizes, M3 through to M12, full set of taps for each taper, plug, and second. He says if you're not sure how to use them, then ask and treat them with some love. More love than the existing sets have had, he says. And I guess that's the problem. They look like a simple thing to use, but if you're not using them correctly and using the correct lubricants and getting down to the right sizes, etc., they may work, but doesn't leave the tool necessarily in great condition. Also says about belts and discs for the big belt sander stroke finisher in three grades, and a set of Forstner bits, and these are for wood only, he says, and they're the larger size drills. For drill for making holes, 10 through to 50 mil. I had to look them up I know what the things are, but I didn't know that's what they were called. They're like a sort of disc with a couple of spikes in them that are actually the cutting edges of the introducing the initial cutting, and then there's a blade portion. And he says that they're only cheap, so treat them with a little care. Don't push them too hard. And give them time to cool down. I replied to Yoshi about the post I mentioned about a box. I hadn't realised it is actually in the title. It said home base box suitable, and because that is where it came from. So I said they were called Tactic. And I had a look, and they're a Chinese make company that produce a number of different brands. But I couldn't actually see that one on the Homebase online store, though maybe they just distributed to different boxes. And then in an interesting coincidence, they were posting on eBay, and they were looking for £12 each or £28 for two. But they would have been shipped from Australia, which is coincidentally where Bunnings, who I mentioned, were seemed to have some connection with Homebase. I extended my welcome to Carl onto the group and requested some pictures of his project to repair chair, which he said he'll look at posting up, so looking forward to those. And I mentioned that Jesus had put a request in for doing a project and for some advice, and Vance was going to be able to help him on Tuesday. But I found a link to the clock I was thinking of, the kit created by somebody that was displaying at the Egham Raspberry Jam, called meanderingpie.wordpress.com, and it was called the Pie Mux Clock. That kit's now sold out, but he's actually doing another newer one, which is available for both the Raspberry Pi, but also would work with an Arduino. So I posted links up, and also found an interesting sand clock when I was looking at links. And a couple of things that were of interest to him, and he posted up a return link for some interesting ferro fluid, which is a sort of magnetic fluid that I think gets moved around using magnets, but it's quite an interesting design. Don't see what's going on behind it, but I imagine it's magnets and it does a display, but also a whole load of other things going on with it. Very interesting. If you've followed the link in his post to a YouTube video, and it did introduce ferrofluid, which looks like an interesting material to add to our maker list. Discovered when I first started, I hadn't heard of it, but Richard introduced me to something called Thermomorph, which you could get at Maplin, but it's quite expensive, and they sell it in quite a large quantity, more than you might need for a project. It was used on the door handle on the fridge. If people wonder what that is, it's basically a type of plastic similar to that's used in 3D printing, but this one is designed to go soft in hot water, just boiling water, and then when it cools, it goes hard. So you can reuse it many times, or you can use it once and create things that you can mold shapes with. Great for putting round cable joints and things. So a bit like shoe glue, but be able to be reused. So thermomorph, yeah, it's, I think goes under quite a number of different names, that the one that Maplin had. If you don't know of that one, then that's a good material to have a look at. And perhaps that's what we need on the wiki, thinking about it, is a list of different materials. And in a section, I guess I could say, not only is it what does our lab do for me, but even the simple seems complex. And Luke says, in recent bad weather, felled an apple tree in my mum's allotment. It has reasonable straight branches. Is it any good for turning? If so, I'll cut some blanks to bring in. And Arthur says that apple can be a nice wood for lots of things, but it will need drying, especially if it's smaller. And he offered to fell the tree and take it away if Luke says it's not so big, could easily get in the boot. But how long will it take to season? Apparently Ian has a moisture meter that could be used to test it, and that was the suggestion, but it would take many months. And Eric posts on the old Ralph from Basing Hack now, gives really a comprehensive explanation. Wood used to be air dried, in brackets seasoned after cutting, say into planks, but it was sometimes left as a whole log, and this could take up to 2 years. When kiln drying was introduced, this reduced the time down to about 2 weeks. Wood dried too quickly can split dangerously, as it is subject to tensions, as the outer has dried more quickly, sealing the moist wood inside. This can, at worst, explode if you are turning it. Turned green, it will probably split and crack later as it dries out. I suspect some investigation is needed to the best way. To probably outside, but covered from the weather, to season it. I suspect this will take at least a year, probably longer. It would be an interesting experiment with pieces left 6 months a year and longer to see the difference, which could be seen by simply sawing a piece off the end. It would probably be best to remove the bark and possibly cut into the size of pieces you intend to use. It would aid the seasoning process. That's a great post there, and it does indicate a depth of knowledge we have within the posters on the Google group. And although I knew some elements about seasoning and about how long it takes from school days and involvement in sourcing wood for projects in woodworking classes, but we had to go to the woodyard, and they indeed did that. They cut things into planks, and they had full-size oak trees seasoning for many years in the same woodyard. Sadly now gone and turned into some housing, as many industrial areas in Victorian planned towns, where they planned various places for such trades to go on. And in fact, I was telling somebody the other day, there were covenants on various properties around. So if you think about Oxford Road area of Reading, where I was brought up in Bedford, there was similar small terraced housing. Although, curiously enough, it turned out that although it looked like a terrace, it was never built as a terrace. They were built as blocks of semi-detached or set of 4 or 8 properties on a plot, but covering two streets, and then exactly adjacent to them, butting up to the property, another property was built some years later. But each corner, where the alleys were, was designated as some kind of a trader. So there were butchers and greengrocers and newsagents. And then there were hot food outlets like fish and chip shops and licensed premises such as pubs and off licenses. And properties around them had covenants on them to say that, first of all, they weren't allowed to object to a licensed premise being a licensed premise, but they also equally didn't allow individual other properties to apply for licenses, and that was all written into the deeds as part of the Victorian planning process. And so Eric's reference there to the tensions building up inside the wood is an interesting and something that, yeah, certainly worth noting if you're just acquiring some wood to do some turning with, because when you've got it spinning around at high speed, exploding on your thing, it wouldn't be a desirable thing to have happen. And looking at the subject of a wasp's nest, I initially thought this was a joke, and but it's not indeed. It says, before I throw it in the bin, would anyone like a wasp's nest to show their kids? Says Gavin, not quite intact. And Robert says, yes, please. So it was immediately claimed, and Gavin posts a picture of it being left behind. Quite a big one. And of course, it's really fitting for makers, because in some ways, these insects are some of the first makers. And as Gavin said, he wonders, given the size of it, where it got all the material. And I think they chew up wood, don't they? So presumably they chewed up wood somewhere. And I think that's part of it. They need water and such material to build a nest. So the downside is, if you have a pond and some dead wood laying around, you're giving all the materials that they need and encouraging them to come, which is not what people want to do generally. And the only good news is that wasps tend to leave their nest in the winter, and the queen goes off and the other workers die, I guess. Whereas bees obviously stay around, but on the other side, bees have a value and people are happy to take them away, whereas wasps don't have value and you usually have to pay to get them disposed of if they're causing a nuisance. And so it's worth checking lofts, and that reminds me that I should do the same. As Ben says, we had the start of a wasp nest in the loft this year. Luckily, I spotted it when it was the size of a golf ball. We've had them before and they're a right hitter. And more news of stock from Ian. I bought some new and different blades for the bandsaw. It is important they are installed correctly. In particular, the guides and the stops need adjusting to suit the different widths. And here is a guide to bandsaw blades. And he puts a link to toughsaws.co.uk. And the blades are eighth, half, quarter wood and quarter metal. He also says, if you put one of these blades in the machine, please take it off again after using it and reattach the label. If anyone wants an intro into setting up the bandsaw, please shout. And a little while back, I mentioned a face post about the Waco Open Day, a machine tool manufacturer or distributor down in, is it Surrey, Sussex, and that I was going to go to see about getting some a lathe for, I guess, for her projects. Anyway, he said, after going to the Work Open Day today, my wallet is crying, but I have gotten this WM180 lathe, and that's a link to an article on it. And indeed, in there, there's a link to a YouTube video showing it in action. So I wonder what sort of size it was. Seems larger than I was expecting for the type of work that Faye was talking about doing, but it's a variable speed, and it shows it going up to 1300 RPM and down to 1 RPM. It's probably, I suppose, half the size perhaps of the large lathe we have. And the video shows unboxing and the various features. So that's worth looking at. So under new tool, I'd say new tool on loan, according to the text that I has posted. And it's on loan currently to our lab. Do not hack it. Hopefully it will find a more permanent home shortly. It's been permanent home in our lab or where it is currently, I'm not sure. Please keep all the bits together, she requests. And says that she's learning about what it can do herself. And Arthur replies saying, I may have the first challenge or job for it as a marine gas tap, a small part. The sort of part of the valve inside it, and he posts a picture of it, a sort of tapered piece with two holes drilled in it by the looks of it. The pictures are huge, and I think piece is actually probably bigger than life size or something, but I think that's what generally happens. So when you post on Google Groups, if you attach a photo, its scale is dependent on the number of pixels in the original picture, but you are able to change the actual size that it's posted at within the post. I can't remember exactly how to do it, but you're able to choose small or medium or something, and that's actually improves the post, because these have got somewhat large. But normally what I do is I reduce the size of the picture before I post it. Speeds it up for people who are downloading, but it's not always possible. If you're doing that from your phone, you just get the native resolution, I guess. And I think about the last post I put up last time, talked about in the podcast, was Jim and his rowing machine. I looked at the pictures, and I see it was actually a link to his own blog and post about the rowing machine project. I thought it was an open source one that he'd found elsewhere, but it seems that he is taking it and doing a second iteration. There was a nibbling tool that Ian posted up about, and I asked if it was his tool or whether it was going to be available as a lab tool, and it is apparently a new R-Lab tool. So that's it's a good thing to know that is available. And David suggested that possibly it could be using an old hover mower impeller, although it would be plastic rather than metal. And because basically the idea of this part is that it has air resistance, and so as you're doing a rowing machine, as you're pulling hard, the resistance increases, because as the speed goes round, the fan effectively is trying to drive more air, and it's done inside a box so that the there's resistance to the air being moved, and that provides the resistance in terms of actual rowing, and rather than weight, or springs, which are other ways of achieving the same thing. And in fact, I think we've got a dead mower that's destined for recycling. So I shall post up about that, because that might have the part in it, because the bit that broke isn't the impeller, although I need to check that. So a note to self. So I come to a thread, which is great, rotating chair project progress. So I mentioned I suggested to Carl about posting some pictures up about his rotating chair project, and he said, I thought I'd start a new thread and explain the project a bit more while I'm at it. I'm a PhD student at uni, formerly at the now defunct School of Systems Engineering. For my research, I found myself needing to pop people into a chair that can rotate by itself using an electric motor. It makes me think immediately of doing the scanning that we did with the Kinect for 3D printing models. So it might be something similar. Since the university doesn't have such a chair, I saw fit to dissolve SSE and demolish the entire engineering workshop and all. Oh, right. Since they saw fit, I see. Oh, dear. I found myself having to improvise. So, and this poor little motor was at some point separated from a mobility scooter it used to be part of. He puts a picture of it. I thought it was actually a windscreen wiper one, but no, it's a mobility scooter. Obviously, it's got a gearbox to turn the wheel, so he said not too shabby. So he said next to the chair, and posts a picture of the chair and the steps that he's put together. And then the great thing in that his initial way of supporting it was to use a sprocket, like basically off a bike. But the second one was covered in tape to act as a guide for the chain, because it's going to be mounted horizontally rather than vertically. And then the next post is, thanks to Alex, I was able to switch out the chain support plate, which was previously a sprocket wrapped in tape, for a laser cut acrylic disc, which he posts a picture of. And then other suggestions have come in about supporting the weight of the chair compared with how it was, and it's currently taken on the sprocket and the motor assembly. So he says he'll be looking at putting a thrust bearing. So again, an individual project, but great help coming from other people, and I'm sure he'll get more feedback having posted the pictures, not just from maybe immediate RLAB people, but others elsewhere who follow the thread. So that's great. So thanks to Carl for that. And Arthur posts that he's sorted out the metric bits in the 1 to 10 mil sizings. He says, for my sanity, please put them back in the right slot or don't put them back at all. And I think that was the problem. The Imperial bits, BSA bits, letter bits, Morse taper bits and long drill bits are in the long blue trays, he adds. And one small update on the Boxford thread. Toby says, last night, or hopefully tonight, that was posted for Tuesday, Richard will be demonstrating the spindle control circuit. No further update on that yet. But they certainly are making good progress with that. And I also noticed that the Shapoko has a note on it saying, pretty close to getting working, but don't use it yet. And in a fusion of projects, Toby posts a picture under the title for attention of Rupert 3D printer carriage and shows a picture of an aluminium plate with a series of holes of different sizes and a large hole in the centre and a particular shape. And it's in reply to Gavin's question about what it is, Rupert explains that it's, well, first of all, he says it's a testament to AutoCAD Fusion 360 pathway, presumably being the CAD package he used to design it. And it's a modified RepRap X carriage, says Rupert. My current one gets worryingly close to melting. And so he's replacing it with the Ali one so that he can use higher temperature plastics. And Ben notes that some of the plastics, high temperature ones, can give off poisonous fumes. So it's something to be aware of. But also Toby provides a bit of information about the process. He says, in case anyone was wondering if the Boxwood can make this, then surely it proves it works fine and don't need to upgrade it. And he says, I would then point out that this was a complete pain to do. Because of the software, it took several hours to make the part, and the spindle was stationary for about 90% of the time. We'll never be in a position to throw the piece of metal into a machine and get this sort of part made, but because it's far too complicated and we don't have enough tool holders. However, it can be made a lot easier than it is, and that's the Boxford Improvement Project, I guess, explained in a nutshell or a sentence. So thanks, Toby, and for posting the picture, and thanks for Rupert for explaining what it is and some bits and pieces about the reason behind it. That's a great use of the thread and gives me great content for the podcast. And two notes on housekeeping. Ian says, I moved a PC and Dell server from the lost and found shelves to the main room. Can someone evaluate and dispose of them appropriately? Adding, putting them back downstairs is inappropriate. He also says, there's a blue box labelled PEP on the shelves. Who claims it? And that the lost and found shelves are mostly empty and available for short-term project storage. Claim a portion of the shelf and label it as yours as long as you're actively working on the project. And Martin asks about a bike. I noticed there was a bike there. Ian says, I'm still waiting for someone to admit ownership. So if you've left a bike in the space, post up on the thread there and let Ian know. More sorting it out is the title of the thread. And Ian posts a link to an eBay auction that has now finished. A CNC lathe. The winning bid was £771.12 out of 24 bids, it says. So I don't think it was anyone from our lab that bid on it, but Toby says a CNC lathe would be so sweet. I hope we can get there in the future. And Toby also asks, anyone any experience of amber spyglass? That's amberspyglass.co.uk. Seem to have a good range of parts would be suitable for the Shapoko, which is why he was looking at them. Decent price on MakerSlide. And has anyone used the site? And Malcolm says they're based in Camberley, so if there are issues, ... They seem to be quite upfront what they're doing and like more inclined to trust them, but nobody has actually used them and posted up here about it yet. Although Alex says twice weekly shipping sounds evidence of a realistic and grounded small-time operation. As Toby says, they say they only ship twice a week, and there's a few indicators quite a few indicators of a small-time operation, which could be either a good or a bad thing. So if anyone knows about a company called amberspyglass.co.uk, then you'll post up with your experience in that thread. And maybe we should add them to the wiki in the supplier page, if that exists. I know I've talked about it before. And more on the housekeeping. Ian posts, I have ordered nitrile gloves, small, medium, large and extra large, acetone, metal cutting discs, masking tape, duct tape, disposable paintbrushes, and hardener for the West epoxy. And a reminder, Toby says that having the gloves is really useful. I wish I was more disciplined in using them. And yeah, I think that's one of the things. The gloves are there to be used to protect people's hands and from all the various chemicals and things that might be being used, or the swarf, etc., from not so much from the machines, as they're not going to, it's not going to protect your hands that way, but it's only protect it from paints and glues, etc. And I remember the discussion I had with Ryan about barrier creams. So I quite like to use a barrier cream. He was particularly emphatic about the importance of using gloves to protect yourself from various chemicals and surfaces of materials and things that could cause skin issues. And so I always talk about looking back at what our lab has done over the years and the history and things. And so it's worth highlighting really Ryan's role in the health and safety aspects of our lab when it was started, and continues now. But it's always a good reminder that they're there to be used, and I think the gloves gives us a good opportunity to reflect on that. And giving credit where credit due is also part of it. And a big thank you from Toby. He says, when I arrived at the space yesterday, and that was posted 23 hours ago, yes, that's yesterday. Whether he was talking about Tuesday or whether he was talking about yesterday, I don't know. I went in yesterday, didn't stay for the evening, as just been travelling. So, but I did a bit of hoovering around and a bit of sweeping and a bit of washing of floors, and also tried doing a bit of wash on the carpet because there were some nasty stains. It hadn't fully dried when I left, but looked as though the stain had been much improved. So Toby saying, when I arrived at the space yesterday, it was clear that a huge effort had gone into sorting out downstairs. So thank you! ! And it's it's always nice when people appreciate what other people have done. So a bit of a thank you there. Good post to see. And one of the things I try and do with the podcast is to pull out information where there's multiple subjects within one thread. And sometimes the title may cause people to skip it and miss useful individual posts. And I think this is an example here. Laser cutting materials was the title. Some huge photos, which could be a problem if for people who were downloading onto their mobile, maybe. But I think it's to do with the resolution size of the iPhone camera sensor making this such large pics. Anyway, the subject was about Emma's question about engraving a chopping board, and it's a wooden chopping board, and questions about whether it would laser. And Tony says, well, engraving any wooden item is possible. Obviously, the deeper the edge, the less food compatible it comes, but is no different from the cut marks on the board. You would need to finish it with a food safe oil stroke wax, which he has if you want to try, he says. So yes, they were going to have a go. Emma was going to have a go with doing that, and Tony posted some pictures of some other objects he'd laser engraved previously. And we've discussed in the past about him having some software and a technique that would allow a PDF of a map to be created as a line drawing and then engravable. The example being the table that's in the chill-out room that was done that way. But one of the things, as he points out, is that you actually have to remove detail that you don't want. Otherwise, it can get too cluttered. So shows chopping boards, a wooden tray, a bamboo tray, and what he refers to as a crest, which was engraved, a family crest. And Hugo, who normally comes and brings us some humour. In this case, comes and brings us some facts. Turning on the Pernickety tag, he said, it's not a crest, it's a coat of arms or armorial bearings. The crest is a small device which sits on top of the helm above the shield. The crest is almost never used independently except as a form of shorthand, usually in a signet ring, where the detail of the coat of arms wouldn't be visible in the wax impression. I think is what he's thinking of it. I assume he's talking about the creation of the signet ring and the wax that's used to create the signet ring in moulding. I'm not sure. Or is he thinking of, and I know signet rings were used to validate a document. So sealing wax was put on and then the ring was pressed into the sealing wax, and basically that made it a valid document. He goes on, the full coat of arms would have a shield, a helm, a coronet, a crest, mantling, field, supporters, and a motto. He said, I may have missed a piece or two, it's been a while. The design of the helm and the coronet indicate the rank within the peerage. In actual arms, the crest would have been a small, usually wooden painted sculpture, mountable on top of the helm for ceremonial purposes. It would have been removed for combat, a turn off Pernickety. So, Tony says, you're right, of course, I was shorthanding for those who had not researched heraldic design. And that actually, I'll have to look back at our family crest and see if we've got all those bits and pieces. So an interesting tip and an interesting rat hole created there inadvertently by the topic of laser engraving. Anyway, Emma comes back saying, I tried doing it and it didn't work. I did a scale cut, which worked fine, but when I tried to cut the letters, it said not enough extend space. I've rehomed and moved the board I was trying to engrave on, but it still doesn't work. And Arthur says, I think it's the error you get when working too close to the edge of the bed. When doing a scan cut, especially at high speed, the laser needs a little room around the workpiece to accelerate up to speed. Otherwise, it would burn too deep at the start and end of each pass as it slows down and speeds up. And Tony confirms, yes, as Arthur said, he's obviously been paying attention. And he goes on and also says, I would always recommend not running jobs with a laser homed at 0-0 for this reason. After homing the laser, just move it out 20 mil in both directions and the error shouldn't appear. So that's the tip that's buried at the end of that thread and is worth mentioning. And perhaps, I don't know, if it's not in the instructions, the guide to using the laser, or not highlighted, then perhaps something that perhaps should be moved so that it's in people's minds at a higher priority, because it's one of those silly things. You may not come across it, but when you do, and it scuppers your job, having that in your mind or easily referenceable in the wiki, it is a great tip. So down to the last few posts for this week. Been a busier week, so it's going to be about 40 minutes or so of podcast, making up for a short and abbreviated one last week. And Google seems to have gone very slow suddenly. Anyway, I'll do the couple it's downloaded. Check out the items in this thread, says Ian. Various items discovered as I tidied on Sunday. If they're yours, claim them. If you want them to be yours, claim them. If they don't get claimed, then the next 10 days I will dispose of them. And that was dated the 23rd. So translate this message into English, it says. And the message is Electrolux Hoover. And I know that was brought in as an attachment. I think it was for the Shapoko, if I remember correctly, as the dust extractor. A base of something which looks like two crossed bars bolted together with feet, by the looks of it. I don't know. I don't recognise those. A circular saw in a box, Malcolm's, I think he says. Weldmate arc welder, which could be Tom's, I suppose. Wolf circular saw. Tooltech arc welder. Couple of arc welding masks probably belong to the arc welders. Vulcanizing clamp. And that would be, they're used for repairing car tyres, I guess. Bicycle unlabeled. A couple of electronic modules. Oh, yeah, they're the the test kit that came from a school. Marion's question mark, not sure what that one is. Remains of an amp. So Scott claims the arc welder and the welding mask. Some Malcolm talks about the circular saw. As I says, if it's not of use to our lab, then other local hack spaces should have first refusal. And Basingstoke said, yeah, we'd gladly put any equipment of this to good use if no one else wants it. And then finally, some embroidered fabric. So if any of those items are of interest or you know of, particularly the crossbars and the router. Anyway, it looks as though they'll have good homes in Basingstoke if people aren't claiming other things. So the amp, that was somebody's project, I think. So Alexander, would it be? So hopefully look through the thread, and if you know who owns the various things, then let them know, because they might not have seen the thread. Not everybody reads the group. And in a thread, which I guess you'd might say there's a hidden meaning, work out the meaning, but Derek's saying, I'm after some balsa wood about 12 mil in diameter and about 2 meters long in total. Anyone know of a local stockist? Yeah, get my teeth back in. And Ian points to Hobbycraft, who do wooden strip. But if it wants to be round, then it could be show you how to use a lathe. Well, of course, he does, as he uses the lathe, a smiley face. So Arthur points out that he thought there was some balsa wood in the space, in the stock, and he found it and put it in the wood section where it should be. Also, it seemed to be tangled up with the welding gear. And the last post perhaps indicates what Derek was looking to make. Tony says, I've made you an elder wand, as befits your status. It's yours if you want it, but maybe too late for your jamboree. So it sounds like that was what the task was. So that was 25th, which was Tuesday, that was posted. So if it was making something for his jamboree, then I don't guess it's not too late. So I guess we'll find out the hidden message behind that in the final post in the set, yet to be posted. And Gavin posts up with the pre-tag project, which is a good one to include in our list. Amplifier. He said, Matt and I mended a sound system this evening, wanted to put it back together in the box, weren't able to do it, but it wouldn't fit on the project itself, so we stashed it on top of the thermoformer. Be gone by the end of next week. If anyone needs it in the meantime, just move it, but handle it with care. And really, the Google group soon seemed to have gone down. I thought it was the internet, but it isn't. It was just the groups, and they've come back now, so I can finish off here. Ian says, I mostly cleared the shelves outside the loos. Let's experiment with them as a place to store current projects. Ground rules only for current ongoing projects, not a place to leave stuff for, quote, until I get round to it. Hold round to it. Yes, and you go thinking of you. Put a project in a box, not on a shelf. Label your box with your name, your contact details, phone and email. To date, put the date on, update the label each time you work on the project. Cross out the old date and add the current date. If you have large bits that won't fit on the shelves, leave them in the workshop out of the way as out of the way as possible. Label them with the same information. We have 120 members, and so storing stuff in the space needs to be understood as a privilege, not a right. Don't abuse the shelves. Whether you think of them as the three-week shelves, the bean queue, or the lost and found in the previous names, only store stuff on the shelves that are genuine project. And Gavin adds, we do need to prominently re-sign the shelves to make it clear they are now for projects. And Arthur posts a picture of the Shapoko axis in action. Can't look at it at the moment because they're taking an age to load up, but you can check out the thread in the last post on the Shapoko Revival thread. Oh no, that was from July the 4th. Oh, I see. We've got multiple pages here. So I thought it looked familiar. That's from some time ago, July the 4th, no less. So if we go to page 5 of the posts. Okay, yeah, so I finished on page 4 last week, and Toby's posted some pictures of the Shapoko machining some clear acrylic with the R-Lab logo. Yeah, so the posts here basically say that a lot of progress has been made, still a few things to be doing, including e-stops and some connectors and some tidying up and making space for it to go downstairs, to be the plan. And an interesting bit of discussion initiated by Simon, who's saying, does anyone, Tony, know if the drag knife cutters in the space have a registration mark sensors on them for print to cut workflows? And Tony says this model doesn't, but he says that he's never had great success with printing and cutting. It'd be easier to get a professional place to make them to order, he suggests. And Ben says that the big ones, which he has at Bad Hack, didn't have either, and points out really it's to do with loading the roll perfectly straight is a tricky thing. And Simon says, I've ordered a Cricut Air 2 and let you know how he gets on with it. So, but interesting, I hadn't really thought about that side of it. So it's sort of things I learn by reading through the posts, even when they're not directly relevant. But I did use the vinyl cutter yesterday. I should post a picture of what I made with that. Interesting enough, finding the, because I needed a GB sticker for the car. It turns, well, I'm sure there will be a lot of discussion around that subject when I post it up. But tricky thing was actually finding the minimum size of characters allowed, so I didn't want to make it any larger than necessary. It came out well. And so, last post for this week, a query for me in saying there's some 9mm plywood labelled M. Kozak in the small room downstairs. Can't find the name. And Arthur questions, is it the chap making shields? I think he was Martin. I seem to remember mentioning him in a podcast recently. So, bit question about that side of it. So, on that note, but looking forward for more information for next week, I shall say, Mike the Bee, signing off.